Though we do not have kings in America or want them, our unconscious mind both has them and wants them. We all know what a true king is, a real king, an ideal king, an archetypal king. He is not a mere politician or soldier. Something in us longs to give him our loyalty and fealty in service and obedience. He is lost but longed for and will someday return, like Arthur. In The Lord of the Rings, Arthur's name is Aragorn. When we read The Lord of the Rings, he returns to his throne in our minds. He was always there. The Lord of the Rings only brings him back into our consciousness from the tomb of the unconscious, where he was sleeping. That's from Peter Kraft. All right, Clifford, we are back again.
Indeed we are.
All right. What are we doing tonight?
Tonight is chapter 8 of book 5, Return of the King. This is Houses of the Healing.
Yep. Not to be confused with Houses of the Holy, which is the Led Zeppelin song. I don't know if
I almost said
related.
That just now. Yeah.
Okay, so this is just going to be another long one again tonight. Like, I don't know. You just can't avoid it with book 5. It's the nature of the beast. Like, this is the most epic book ever written, perhaps maybe the Iliad, like outside of that. All right. So, I mean, it's, you know, we only get one shot at this. We got to do it, give it proper treatment. So, I don't know. Anyways, so yeah, let's just jump straight to Cliff's notes. What do you got?
Okay. So, Merry follows the bodies of Théoden and Éowyn as they are borne into the city of Gondor. After Pippin finds him, he is taken to the House of the Healing, where Gandalf is anxiously attending to Faramir and Éowyn. Aragorn insists on remaining a stranger outside the walls of Gondor, waiting to claim his throne until the time is right. He ventured inside the walls to heal Faramir, Éowyn, and Merry, all variously stricken with the Black Shadow, beyond the powers of the healers of Gondor. After each of the three emerged from their comas, Aragorn moves on to heal many other soldiers before leaving the city as quietly as he came.
All right, excellent. Okay. All right, feelings. What do we think of this one?
In some ways, this is like one of those, a little bit like a loose ends chapter. Like we get the aftermath of the battle. People are meeting each other again, like, oh, sigh of relief. Everything's all good. So at least with Merry and Pippin meeting again, we get like the, you know, those are like some of our very relatable characters.
Right.
Previously right, jokesters, now more serious, but total relief to see them come back together. But then also very stern. Like this is Aragorn. Like we get the sense that it's like heavy setup for his importance. And then also he's dealing with, you know, basically saving the lives of three important characters.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, though, because Aragorn is himself, I don't know if stern's the right word, but it's weighty.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then even Aragorn's kind of lighthearted at points, too.
Yes.
Which is kind of, yeah. I don't know, it's fine. I personally think this is potentially the most underrated chapter in all of Lord of the Rings.
Bold statement.
Yeah, okay. And I think like this chapter really was a masterstroke chapter here, because not only does it have/highlight a hospital scene after a major battle, you know, and Tolkien himself would have experienced that because he was in the hospital bed for months and stuff. It also kind of harnesses the whole area to fulfill and help forward the plot, or at least the themes of the book.
That's a great point.
So I think that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. It does, I think, without us totally knowing it, after all the big plot blow by blow battles, this embeds a lot of, sort of nuance and not exactly, I guess it's kind of character development for Aragorn in a way. even though we know him well already, this is adding to his character and kind of building him up in a different way.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so lots to talk about because we're going to get back to Aragorn, obviously, throughout this thing. And then we're going to have about a short conversation at the very end about his character development. Okay, but anyways, yeah, so like you said, it opened with Merry walking through Minas Tirith himself, Eowyn and Théoden's bodies near him. There was a cool honor guard description of the guys near Beowulf, or near Beowulf, near Théoden. The king's body they covered with great cloth of gold, and they bore torches about him, and their flames, pale in the sunlight, were fluttered by the wind. Okay, so what do we think of Merry's entrance? We're not going to read any of it, but what do we think?
Interesting, good. I liked his description of the city. Like he feels like it's he's like kind of in shock and awe. You also get this sense of like the circles of Gondor are really evident, like burning refuse on the outside and then slowly entering the rings, and it's getting like less terrible battlefield, more solemn. But he's like searching for the point of it all. He seems totally like lost emotionally and physically.
Yeah, so literally lost, and then also seemed despairing. I thought almost like emo thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't know what he's living for anymore.
Yeah, right? Some of the lines here. To Merry, the ascent seemed age-long, a meaningless journey in a hateful dream. He was walking in darkness. This is a tunnel leading to a tomb. There we shall stay forever. So, yeah, definitely emo.
It's almost like he thinks he's dead already or something. Right. Or he thinks he's dying.
Right, right. And so Pippin finds him, Merry's arms immobile because he's stabbed the Nazgul, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, that's where kind of, I don't know, the problems are coming from. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Yeah, and it was weird. Like, Merry was not cheerful or even cheered up to be reunited with Pippin. You know, that was the first weird thing about this. Like, that's definitely off, right, from everything we know about these two's character. Let's see. Who is this? Fleming Rutledge. She has this good passage that I'll just read real quick. They, being Merry and Pippin, have not seen one another since Pippin rode away with Gandalf from Isengard, leaving Merry behind as like excess baggage. It has been only 10 days, but an age of the world has passed in the meantime, and these two little people, approximately equivalent in emotional maturity to 13-year-olds when they set out heedlessly from the Shire, have lived several lifetimes of trial. The physical ordeals have not been the half of it. When we think of the spectrum of human behavior they have seen, ranging from cowardice, deceit, treachery, lies, and murder on the one hand, to bravery, mercy, wisdom, nobility, and self-sacrifice on the other, it staggers the imagination. I don't really have anything else to say about that, but I thought that was just good. So
yeah, definitely. You get the immediate sense of like how world-weary both of them are.
Mm-hmm. Definitely how much more they've been through and grown up.
Right, yeah. Right. And then pretty promptly, Merry just passes out.
Right, right. So they squat down, and then no sooner do they squat down, maybe a little bit sooner than, well, I don't know. A little bit of time passes, but what? Not long before, you want to take it?
It was not long before Gandalf himself came in search of them. He stooped over Merry and caressed his brow, and then he lifted him carefully. "He should have been born in honor into this city," he said. "He has well repaid my trust, for if Elrond had not yielded to me, neither of you would have set out, and then far more grievous would the evils of this day have been." He sighed. "And yet here is another charge on my hands, while all the time the battle hangs in the balance."
Okay. So apparently do you think Gandalf already knows what Merry did in the battle, or that's just he just knows he was in the battle, so that's honor enough?
I get the sense that he kind of knows, even though I'm not sure how he knows, other than he's Gandalf. The fact that he's saying specifically that he should have been born in honor and that the day would have been much worse seems like he knows that Merry was like a turning point in the battle, not just contributing.
Yeah, maybe the guards that are lifting the bodies told Gandalf, but then I didn't think anybody was really around when Merry stabbed him. So unless you talk to Eowyn. Like, how would they have known? But whatever.
Or Gandalf infers from the way his arm is or something like that.
Right. So more importantly, though, we explicitly get the references to all the stuff in Rivendell when they were picking out the council and everything. Like, there is the obvious question that lots of readers themselves were asking, like, why aren't we sending Glorfindel on this fellowship? You know, and Gandalf's like, Glorfindel's great. He could maybe storm a tower, but, you know, there's some stuff that he can't. You can't do everything, you know. And why don't we just trust to the friendship and loyalty of these hobbits instead? And then, you know, now we've read about it. Merry, he saved Eowyn and helps kill the Nazgul. Pippin, at a minimum, was the catalyst to save Faramir. So literally, without these two hobbits, the royal families of these kingdoms would be destroyed.
Definitely.
You know? Let's see. All right, meat of the chapter. Should we start?
Sure. Real quick, Gandalf randomly references that the battle is still going on. Everything hangs in the balance. Real quick, what is he referring to? Because didn't we already, in previous two chapters back, we know that Aragorn showed up, right?
So Théoden probably died about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
Aragorn probably didn't show up until like 10 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
And then the battle went all the way until dusk, because it still took him forever to finish off all the evil men that were in the city and all the orcs and stuff, right? Uh-huh. Whereas they're walking right now, it's probably midday.
Okay.
So the battle's still out there, and Gandalf, he's playing medic instead of fighting out on the field.
Okay. Makes sense.
So, yeah. Good point to bring that up.
So at last, Faramir and Eowyn and Meriadoc were laid in beds in the Houses of the Healing, and there they were tended well. For though all lore was in these latter days fallen from its fullness of old, the leechcraft of Gondor was still wise and skilled in the healing of wound and hurt, and all such sickness as east of the sea mortal men were subject to, save old age only. For that they found no cure, and indeed the span of their lives had now waned to little more than that of other men, and those among them who passed the tale of 50 years with vigor were grown few, save in some houses of pure blood. But now their art and knowledge were baffled, for there were many sick of a malady that would not be healed, and they called it the Black Shadow, for it came from the Nazgul. And those who were stricken with it fell slowly into an ever deeper dream, and then passed to silence and a deadly cold, and so died. And it seemed to the tenders of the sick that on the halfling and on the Lady of Rohan this malady lay heavily. Still at whiles, as the morning wore away, they would speak, murmuring in their dreams, and the watchers listened to all that they said, hoping perhaps to learn something that would help them to understand their hurts. But soon they began to fall down into darkness, and as the sun turned west, a gray shadow crept over their faces. But Faramir burned with a fever that would not abate.
All right. A lot there. I probably have too much, but so I'll just go real quick. So, all right. So for the past two pages, he's been called Merry, but now at the very top here, he's called Meriadoc.
Sounds formal, like he's dying.
Oh, all right.
At least that was my take on it.
No, like, so here's my take. I think, you know, of course, I get it. I know Tolkien wrote the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. But I think there's two narrative accounts being smashed together.
Mm.
All right, you know, okay. So spoiler, if you don't actually know the end of Lord of the Rings and everything, so seriously, like, just skip a minute ahead. Spoiler. All right. Bilbo and Frodo, they write the Red Book of Lord of the Rings, you know, afterwards, right, in their lifetime. And then that, after a few hundred years after Lord of the Rings, that makes its way to Gondor. And then a Gondor scribe takes it and he writes the Lord of the Rings account that we're reading. I think the parts, you know, like that, the first two pages of this chapter was part of, like, Frodo's account where he talked to Merry and Pippin themselves to just get that. And the scribe just copied and pasted that. But then when he starts using the high voice that we've seen for so many chapters, that's just the scribe himself kind of like doing the epic part, you know?
Okay.
That's my thought. Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes also this chapter is like kind of a random bit of narration. You know, we've talked before about like Tolkien stays away from the third person omniscient, and we tend to see like kind of third person personal where we follow a character. Here, this is a random bit of like appendix style history of Gondor, talking about their life, their medicine, their lives, etc.
Right. So, all right. On to the medicine, the leechcraft. It's just a healthy reminder that even though I think at times it would be cool to live in like some historical past, at the end of the day, I don't
be
want
grateful
to.
Be grateful when you go to the hospital, they don't have leeches.
Right. The leeches, that's enough by itself. But yeah, all medicine sucks compared to ours. None of us would actually be able to live in the past. Yeah. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. And then also it was funny too. Gondor, obviously they've declined as a people. We've talked about that at length, but their healing techniques are still pretty good. The only thing they couldn't solve was old age. But as we know, boy, oh boy, those Numenoreans tried. was... So go back, listen to the Numenor specials if you want to hear more about that.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so many references all throughout fiction, but
right.
Once people start getting obsessed with living forever, it really is like an obsession.
Yeah. Yeah. Then this is also fun. Let's put our 1950s caps on. That's when Lord of the Rings came out. But at that point, the Silmarillion was still under wraps. So one, nobody would know about the epic fall of Numenor and the quest for immortality that we just referenced, right? Mm. And then two, you know, lines like, "And all such sickness as east of the sea mortal men were subject to," that must have like stirred readers' curiosity.
Yeah, like, it's like east tantalizing, of the sea. Right?
Yeah, it's like, well, we're east of the sea now, so what's west of the sea?
Right, right.
So just always keep that in mind, because like that's where the craving for the Silmarillion came from, and rightfully so. And then, but then they got the Silmarillion, and they're like, whoa, I don't know what this is.
Right, right. But, and yeah. This Tolkien, I mean, we've talked before about his settings, like he's. Even the Shire starts out and it's like almost a pre-industrial England.
Yeah.
Where it's just familiar enough that people can envision it and think of what was. And it's like this slightly imagined past. This feels similar. Like it's just within the realm of imagination that these hardy people are living vigorously past 100. The people are kind of like, what? You know, and starting to think of like, well, what if that was even greater in the past? And it's that same sort of like he's like tempting the readers with an idea but not going into too much. So I totally agree. Like you can imagine people being like, well, so if these old guys are, you know, living to 120, what did that mean for their forebears or whatever?
Do we think the Black Shadow was a soft reference to the untreatable Black Death?
Could be. Yeah.
Black Death is what?
The plague.
Yeah, bubonic plague, right? Mm-hmm. And the really famous one, the one that was like in the, I think it was the 1300s, like a third of Europe died.
Yeah, months.
Yeah. Crazy. Coronavirus is bad, you know, compared to that.
Like, well, bad what, in, weren't there, quotes. I remember in school, it was like one third of Europe dies in the Black Plague, but weren't there actually like dozens of plagues? Just recurring throughout the Middle Ages, and some were worse than others.
Yeah, but the bubonic plague was that one bad one. It was in like right at the end of what you would call the medieval times, because the Renaissance starts and that's kind of not medieval times anymore. So it's like that 1300s before the 1400s, and it was like the last bad thing, and then things can kind of start to take off after that. Even though things had already been kind of taken, I don't know. Like that's a complicated topic. But yeah, there's always like plagues, you know, like before coronavirus, the last famous one was like Spanish influenza. You could call that a plague. You know, and that's the flu. We still have it today. But yeah. So I don't know. Maybe the Black Shadow is a reference to that. But then again, they know the cause of this. It's if you brushed up with the Nazgul in battle, you probably got this. Like even though it's the Lord of the Nazgul is dead, the other ones still have the problem. So, I don't know. Yeah, so now the case is laid out. Faramir, Eowyn, and Merry, they got to be healed from this, along with a bunch of other people. So,
One brief note on that. I feel like the implication of this paragraph is like that it's something otherworldly, where they're basically, the way I interpreted this, the houses of healing in Gondor can treat all the normal stuff very well. So, like, every worldly thing that they've come across, doable. This is something different that they are not familiar with, because it's not of the normal realm of experience.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, like, I don't know if we're gonna read it, but even Gandalf has problems with this, which is kind of weird. Let's see. All right, and then we introduce someone who I cannot say is my favorite character, but she's very memorable. So I'll take this. Then the old wife Irareth. Is that how we're gonna go with it? Irareth.
Sure.
Irareth. How do you want to say this?
Eorath?
Eorith? No, Eorith. I'm going with Eorith. All right. Okay. Then an old wife, Eorith, the eldest of women who served in the house, looking at the fair face of Faramir, wept, for all the people loved him. And she said, "Alas, if he should die, would that there were kings in Gondor, as there were once upon a time, they say. For it is said in old lore, the hands of a king are the hands of a healer. And so the rightful king could ever be known." So then Gandalf comes in and says, "Well, how funny you should say that. There's some strange stories about the battle going on downstairs."
Yeah, like, have you heard anything about that?
But all right, so that's how I kind of read it, like, oh, Gandalf knows it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But the way some of these people in the books were interpreting, like the supplementary books I was reading, interpreted it was like this Eorath lady gave Gandalf the idea.
I read that as well.
Is that how you read it?
Yeah, he wasn't aware of this bit of old lore about the healing hands, and it kind of sparked an idea for him.
Right. Well, this Eorath lady sparked the idea for him. Yeah. Yeah. So, big credit to her, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's a little bit of a comical character, I think, as we see in a little bit. Yeah. I don't know if Tolkien was envisioning someone specific or just like an assortment of like kind of like nattering.
Right. Right.
Old ladies or something like that. But
yeah, it's like, I don't know. Yeah. She sounds like, I don't know, everybody has the stereotypical old lady. Everybody knows somebody that's kind of like this. We won't go further than that, but yeah.
Recording, if you want to play it.
Oh, really? Okay, let's do it. Yeah. Nice choice, Clifford. I was tempted to read this one, but then I thought, maybe we won't, but we're definitely reading it now.
Now, as the sun went down, Aragorn and Éomer and Imrahil drew near the city with their captains and knights. And when they came before the gate, Aragorn said, "Behold, the sun setting in a great fire. It is a sign of the end and fall of many things and a change in the tides of the world. But this city and realm has rested in the charge of the stewards for many long years. And I fear that if I enter it unbidden, then doubt and debate may arise, which should not be while this war is fought. I will not enter in, nor make any claim, until it be seen whether we or Mordor shall prevail. Men shall pitch my tents upon the field, and here I will await the welcome of the lord of the city." But Éomer said, "Already you have raised the banner of the kings and displayed the tokens of Elendil's house. Will you suffer these to be challenged?" "No," said Aragorn, "but I deem the time unripe, and I have no mind for strife except with our enemy and his servants."
Well done, Clifford. Well done. I liked your Aragorn. Thank you. Yeah, excellent. All right, yeah, so, yeah, I liked your Aragorn.
Thanks. All
right, let me get back to my notes. Yeah, so, well, you take it. What's the deal? Explain what you just read.
Okay, so this is now end of the battle day, right? Just as we were talking about a couple of minutes ago. These are basically the champions, who the guys leading the whole army on the field are returning to Gondor, and Aragorn basically says, "You go ahead, guys, I'm gonna stay out here. It's not the right time for me to show up and be like, hey, I'm the king, by the way, you know, like, sorry that your city's in shambles."
And why is that?
It seems like it's a couple things. He wants to follow the proper sequence of things, wants to make sure that the steward that is coming is received in the right way. I think it's almost sort of political. I think he's acknowledging that the stewards have been in control of the city for hundreds of years, right? Generations. And that he will be seen as a usurper if he shows up too quickly, too easily. And he wants to make sure that he's coming with good tidings, with a complete battle victory, you know, and not just showing up in the middle of chaos, right?
Right, and not just that, but who do they think he's got to take leadership from?
Denethor, right?
Right.
Who we know is pretty much off his rocker. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, by this point, he's dead, but they don't know that yet.
Yeah. Imrahil seems to be referencing the crazy iteration of Denethor that we came into contact with a few chapters ago.
Right, and so Aragorn, always the diplomat, he's just ready. No, you know, we won the battle, but Mordor is still fully at large, very We are not sure we're going to come through this, so we're not going to prematurely celebrate anyways, and we're definitely not going to cause any friction between any of our forces here. So, like, I'm just going to wait outside, even though Imrahil says, like, you look like a beggar. And he's like, no, don't worry about it. Like, it's good.
He takes down his special Star of the North, right, and gives it to the Sons of Elrond.
Yeah, and he wraps up all his banners and hides everything, kind of, at least that's what we...
Pretending like he's just a random army captain, basically, yeah. And not a special king.
Most definitely. All right, so Imrahil and Éomer, they go and enter Minas Tirith. They go all the way up to the Citadel, look for Denethor. His chair's empty, obviously. Théoden's body is there, though, and it doesn't look like he's dead, but in the most peaceful sleep possible, which is very cool. Just another nod to my most improved character over the course of the rings. Imrahil has actually then fills Éomer in that Éowyn's not dead. Because if you remember, Éomer went into beast mode because he thought both the king and his sister were dead. Mm-hmm. But then Imrahil had, when they were bringing the bodies back, Imrahil had actually saw him and said, you guys need better medics because she's still alive. Like, can you guys check a pulse? So anyways, then they find that out. But actually, yeah, that just jumps straight into whatever Éomer's saying.
Then hope unlooked for came so suddenly to Éomer's heart, and with it the bite of care and fear renewed, that he said no more, but turned and went swiftly from the hall, and the prince followed him. And when they came forth, evening had fallen, and many stars were in the sky. And there came Gandalf on foot, and with him one cloaked in grey, and they met before the doors of the House of Healing. And they greeted Gandalf and said, we seek the steward, and men say that he is in this house. Has any hurt befallen him? And the Lady Éowyn, where is she?
And Gandalf answered, she lies within and is not dead, but is near death. But the Lord Faramir is wounded by an evil dart, as you have heard, and he is now the steward, for Denethor has departed, and his house is in ashes. And they were filled with grief and wonder at the tale that he told.
But Imrahil said, so victory is shorn of gladness, and it is bitter bought if both Gondor and Rohan are in one day bereft of their lords. Éomer rules the Rohirrim. Who shall rule the city meanwhile? Shall we not send now for the Lord Aragorn?
And the cloaked man spoke and said, he is come. And they saw as he stepped into the light of the lantern by the door that it was Aragorn, wrapped in the gray cloak of Lórien above his mail, and bearing no other token than the green stone of Galadriel. I have come because Gandalf begs me to do so, he said. But for the present, I am but the captain of the Dúnedain of Arnor, and the Lord of Dol Amroth shall rule the city until Faramir wakes. But it is my counsel that Gandalf should rule all of us in the days that follow and our dealings with the enemy. And they agreed upon that.
Then Gandalf said, let us not stay at the door, for the time is urgent. Let us enter, for it is only in the coming of Aragorn that any hope remains for the sick that lie in the house. Thus spake Eärith, wise woman of Gondor. The hands of the king are the hands of a healer, and so shall the rightful king be known.
All right, so this is excellent. This is cool. I kind of love it that they spend just a few minutes clearly laying out why Aragorn's not going to enter the city, and then he does 5 minutes later.
But notably with Gandalf, right? I think it's
at Gandalf's insistence. Right. Yeah.
Gandalf goes to fetch him and brings him in, but he's cloaked in, he's unmarked, basically. He shows up in an unmarked car.
Right. Besides the green stone of Galadriel, but we can talk about that in a second. So, yeah, this Imrahil guy, he gets cut out of the movie, but he's actually pretty important because he's the effective leader of Gondor in the absence Faramir's healing up and Aragorn's in disguise, right?
And he was effectively the leader of Gondor in the battle, right? While Denethor was kind of abdicating his role.
Same with Gandalf being the medic too. Right. Yeah. So let's see. I think it's kind of cool how they say Aragorn says, let's all recognize that Gandalf's really the head commander in chief of all the good forces too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that I think that'll be a concept for next chapter, so long as I have it right. Maybe not, but we'll see.
Okay. What do you think about this whole Aragorn is a healer situation, or the king being a healer? This feels very, very loaded.
Let's keep going with a little bit and then
come back to it.
We got some lighthearted banter to go through first here, right?
Okay.
So immediately Aragorn walks in and it's a fun conversation. So Let's see. Then Aragorn entered first, and others followed, and there at the door were two guards in the livery of the Citadel, one tall, but the other scarce the height of a boy. And when he saw them, he cried aloud in surprise and joy, "Strider, how splendid! Do you know, I guessed it was you and the black ships, but they are all shouting corsairs and wouldn't listen to me. How did you do it?"
Aragorn laughed and took the hobbit by the hand. "Well met indeed," he said, "but there is not time yet for travelers' tales."
But Imrahil said to Éomer, "Is it thus that we speak to our kings? Yet maybe he will wear his crown in some other name."
And Aragorn, hearing him, turned and said, "Verily, for in the high tongue of old I am Elisar, the Elfstone, Envinyatar, the Renewer." And he lifted from his breast the green stone that lay there. "But Strider shall be the name of my house, if that ever be established. In the high tongue it will not sound so ill, and Telkantar I will be, and all the heirs of my body."
All right. Okay, so that's, I think that was fun, but it's, I think this is also kind of good to go over, because it's, you know, Pippin sees him on duty, and he's speaking out of turn, but he sees him as just Strider. And, you know, mm-hmm. Pippin's used to calling him Strider ever since he met him in Bree, but right now he really probably does look just like that again. Like, mm-hmm. he doesn't look like the king that just rode off the ships, the black ships, in the most epic fashion ever in the history of literature. He's back to just being Strider. And then Pippin, you know, he also takes a point to ask what Tolkien has not sufficiently explained yet in the book. All right, how exactly did Aragorn get here? We saw him marching with the ghosts, and then all of a sudden he's popping out of the ship. So, like, if you're reading this for the first time, you got hazy ideas about how he did it, but we still want some more clarity. But Aragorn just shuts it down, because it's like, not time to swap stories yet. Hold on. Names, too. We've gone over Elisar, right? What is Elisar? Right.
It's Elvish for Elfstone.
Yeah, right. So the elf stone, and that's because he's got that, he says it's the green stone on his breast that he got from Galadriel. Do we remember this thing?
Yeah, right. This was the gift that he received from Galadriel in Lothlorien.
Right, so he received that, and then
wasn't there also a prophecy of some sort that called him Elfstone before then?
Yeah, so like the name was said, I think, at his birth, and then there's a prophecy that he would be called that, and then the green elf stone actually came from Arendil, because it's in Bilbo's song. Remember when he sang the song of Arendil and Rivendell? And that stone line in the song was in there because Aragorn insisted on it. So supposedly, oh, I can't say that. Supposedly somehow this stone might have gotten back to Middle Earth and given to Galadriel, and then she's the one that gave it to Aragorn. Kind of complicated, but potentially that stone actually even helped her preserve Lothlorien, but then that was probably, it was actually more so a ring, but I don't know. Like, Tolkien had working ideas with that and stuff. That new name that he had was Envinyatar, the Renewer, but yeah, that sounds totally fitting, right?
Makes sense, but yeah, that was totally a new one.
Right, and we've done enough history in Numenor and Gondor that all the Tars and the Yatars sound, and the Vins sound totally in line with everything with Gondor, right? But what'd you think about how he's still actually attached to the name Strider? I thought that was kind of
That was cool. In the past, I thought it was like, oh, charming, like he goes by his old nickname in addition to having his fancy formal name. But this was a twist that he's saying, like, I'm going to use my nickname in the fancy language as my real name forever, right? It's kind of like I'm really setting it in stone, which is kind of fun.
Right. I thought it was kind of like a last attachment that's now going to be immortalized of like his northern wandering days, you know, the not all who wander are lost days, you know?
Right. It's also like everything, so many other things about the kingly side of his personality are like bestowed on him already and like prophesied. This is seems like one thing that he actually gets to, he gets to put his own mark on it.
Right.
And it's not just like a preordained, you are Elfstone, etc. He gets to have his own signature.
Right, because who else would actually like keep that? Right. All right. Okay, but going on, Merry and Eowyn's conditions are deteriorating, right? I cannot talk today. I'm just mushing words constantly. Aragorn inspects Faramir, Eowyn, Merry, assesses the situation. Aragorn says, here I must put forth all such power and skill as is given to me. Would that Elrond were here. Because supposedly he's even better at this. Trivia. This is not the first time Aragorn's dealt with the Black Shadow disease. What was the first time?
When Frodo was stabbed in the shoulder, right?
Right.
On Weathertop.
Yep. And then
But Elrond was at Aragorn's side, right? For that.
So Aragorn kind of held him up decently for like 2 weeks to get from Weathertop to Rivendell. Yeah. Okay. But then Elrond had to do the finishing push to like finally really heal him up as soon as he got to Rivendell. All right. So anyways, Aragorn says right to work on Faramir first. Aragorn asks Irareth, that's the lady, what healing herbs they have. Irareth begins to talk his ear off. And Aragorn's like, no, I just want Athelas, which, as we said, we've seen that before, right? Because that's what he used to heal Frodo. Or at least not quite heal him, but make him, I don't know, hold him over at Weathertop to Rivendell, right? And Irareth only recognized it by its name, Kingsfoil. And they don't carry that because it's never been useful before and it just grows in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
Foil just means leaf, I believe, in Anglo-Saxon. So that explains that in its name, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the king's part is about to be explained, I guess. Mm-hmm. Or it already has been because, you know, Aragorn's already used this before. But yeah.
Yeah, this part is kind of like lighthearted and funny, and Irareth is being a little bit annoying and like, oh, you should have said that the first time. I didn't know what you meant. But it also seems like very blunt that she's like, we have no use for that. It's the one herb we don't keep around.
Yeah. Well, and she, but
like
she's...
we've lost all knowledge of what it was for, and then it gets reemphasized later, which is kind of unique. It's like, very, very explicit that some aspect of healing here that Aragorn's introducing has been lost.
Right. Well, and she says, it grew in the forest that it would walk around it and stuff. Like I would see it all the time wondering like, oh, why is it called that? You know, like never knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And that just completely unrelated reminds me of like, it's that kind of stuff. I've been tempted to get into botany just so that I could like walk around the forest, just being able to.
We've been trying to learn the plants out here. Mm. A friend of ours is like studied ecology, and walking anywhere with her is like that. Like she will literally point to everything and knows the name of it and what animals eat it and what it's for. And it's so cool.
Yeah, that one's pretty cool. And I can pick up hobbies. I'm starting to pick up hobbies like pretty easily now. Like actually be able to be good at it and stuff. But that one just seems way out of hand. Like, that one's be too hard for me, you know. And that's a dying art because everybody's urbanizing.
Mm-hmm. Although not to make like a product pitch here, but some of those apps that do the AI identification of plants, pretty cool.
Oh yeah,
pretty fun.
Interesting. Anyways, well, that's
who knows if they
could
identify Kingsfoil.
Right. All right. Okay. So let's see. You know. So Irareth keeps going on, and Gandalf literally doesn't have time for her, you know, because it's like all these people are actually like kind of on the clock, you know, to be saved and stuff. And he has like the famous because they're like, let's get this, you know, leaf. If we got to ride out for it into that forest that you're talking about, I'll take Shadowfax. And then the famous line, you know, Shadowfax will show you the meaning of haste, right?
It's also like Aragorn and Gandalf are both like two of the most intensely patient and respectful characters in the whole book. And this is like the one time that they let their guard down, and they're like both a little bit snappy with this old lady, which is, it's kind of funny. It's also like it weirdly pivots into like what I envisioned being like a medical room surgery drama where like everyone's like yelling at each other, right? Like, give me the king's foil.
I don't know. No, it is not like a medical drama show. But I guess it's fine if you have that in your head. But that is not.
No. And that's the wrong mood, maybe. But it is funny that Aragorn and Gandalf both are, their stress is visible here. And they do not have a long amount of patience for your ref.
Right. All right. So Aragorn, he assesses Faramir, and he's seeing the Southron arrow that I got shot with, that's already healing. But what does he say? weariness, grief for his father's mood, a wound, and all over the black breath, said Aragorn. He is a man of staunch will, for already he had come close under the shadow before ever he rode to battle on the Outwalls. Slowly the dark must have crept on him, and even as he fought and strove to hold his outpost, would that I could have been here sooner. So, he's saying, Faramir, he's been dealing with this basically, remember early in chapter 4, the Nazgul literally chases him down across the Pelennor and then Gandalf scares him away. Like, it's that was his brush with the Nazgul, and ever since then it's slowly
I read this even different, that he all the way back to his hidden fortress over in what's it called, where he met Frodo and Sam, Ithilien.
Well, when did he come in contact with Nazgul over there?
Not explicitly in contact with the Nazgul, but just being so close to Mordor and trying to hold his fortress, it was like chronically wearing him down. Like that exposure set him up to be more vulnerable. That was my interpretation.
Well, all right, he's been weary and grieving for weeks and months and stuff, but I think, like, you know, like to actually have this black shadow on you, you have to have come in contact with the Nazgul, so that just made it like worse, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, the one slowly the dark must have crept on him, even as he fought and strove to hold his outpost. His outpost, well, that, I read, is Ithilien.
No, that's the Outwalls of the battle. So like he gets back. And then Denethor sends him out to that larger circle near Osgiliath, and then he was like the last one to get back with all his people. Remember that?
Okay.
Chapter 4 was so big that it's kind of confusing, so you got to like rehash it to make sure you understand. But
Okay. Fair enough. Anyways, chronic exposure in a way. Right. No one blow that dealt it that did this to him.
Right. All right. So this herb master shows up, and Aragorn, he's another one. Aragorn just does not have time for his trivia, partially because Aragorn already knows everything he's going to say, because he's just as learned, right? Mm-hmm. So the herb master confirms to Aragorn that they don't keep the King's Foil Aethelas, which we already knew. Why is that?
This
you want to read
one,
his response?
Sure. This reinforces what we were just saying.
Yeah.
For it has no virtue that we know of, save perhaps to sweeten the fouled air and to drive away some passing heaviness. Unless, of course, you give heed to rhymes of old days which women such as our good old Eireth still repeat without understanding. When the black breath blows and death's shadow grows and all lights pass, come Aethelas, life to the dying in the king's hand lying. It is but a doggerel, I fear, garbled in the memory of old wives. Its meaning I leave to your judgment, if indeed it has any. But old folk still use an infusion of the herb for headaches. So, first of all, that the little rhyme that he repeats is perfectly suited for the moment. It's like, to a T. It's like, okay, nice. And then, just kind of more of that, the comedy that's woven in here that you maybe don't pick up on if you're reading it right away, is like this guy's kind of a buffoon and just wants to like talk language with Aragorn, and Aragorn's like, okay, you've told me three names for this thing. Do you actually have any, or did you just show up here to talk to me about it? And of course he doesn't have any.
Right. That's the thing. It's like the reader's getting frustrated with Gandalf and Aragorn at these people's bumbling, you know?
Right, exactly. but I couldn't help but feel like Tolkien was either like taking a playful jab at like Oxford professors or something that he knew, or making fun of himself, like knowing a lot about language and words.
Yeah.
I could read it either way, or like, you know, criticizing some other, like someone else in the English department for like obsessing over a certain type of etymology and having no practical know-how of what was going on or something like that.
Yeah. Or it's just, I don't know. It's just, he's intentionally trying to make the chapter more lighthearted for intentional reasons. Maybe like most of book 5 has been heavy. This is serious stuff that they're dealing with right now too, you know? So I don't know. Maybe he's just playfully having fun. but we've seen like this this thing where he's mentioning rhymes like this, rhymes of old days which women still repeat without understanding. We saw this all the way back in Bree when he tried reconstructing nursery rhymes, like he did like the hey diddle diddle cat and the fiddle one, right? Frodo's song in Bree was based off, or was like a potentially like early archaic version of that, you know. So he loves that, you know, and that's what basically the Grim Grimm brothers were working off when they came up with the Grimm's fairy tales, collecting them all, right? Because they were probably fuller, more serious things, and then they were reduced to the kids' things, right? So this is just another example of that. But I don't know. Go back to all those early episodes way back that are hard for us to remember at this point. So... Yeah. All right. So anyways, then a cooler scene than I remember takes place. And this is actually what I decided to read. So.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Now Aragorn knelt beside Faramir and held a hand upon his brow. And those that watched felt that some great struggle was going on. For Aragorn's face grew gray with weariness. And ever and anon he called the name of Faramir, but each time more faintly to their hearing. As if Aragorn himself was removed from them and walked afar in some dark vale, calling for one that was lost. And at last Birgil came running in, and he bore six leaves in a cloth. "It is Kingsfoil, sir," he said, "but not fresh, I fear. It must have been culled 2 weeks ago at the least. I hope it will serve, sir." Then, looking at Faramir, he burst into tears. But Aragorn smiled. "It will serve," he said. "The worst is over now. Stay, and be comforted." Then, taking two leaves, he laid them in his hands and breathed on them. And then he crushed them, and straightway a living freshness filled the room, as if the air itself awoke and tingled, sparkling with joy. And then he cast the leaves into the bowls of steaming water that were brought to him, and at once all hearts were lightened, for the fragrance that came from each was like a memory of dewy mornings of unshadowed sun and some land of which the fair world in spring is itself but a fleeting memory. But Aragorn stood up as one refreshed, and his eyes smiled as he held a bowl before Faramir's dreaming face. "Well, now, who would have believed it?" said Arwerth to the woman that stood beside her. "The weed is better than I thought. It reminds me of the roses of Imlath Melui when I was a lass, and no king could ask for better." Suddenly, Faramir stirred, and he opened his eyes, and he looked on Aragorn, who bent over him, and a light of knowledge and love was kindled in his eyes, and he spoke softly. "My lord, you called me. I come. What does the king command?" "Walk no more in the shadows, but awake," said Aragorn. "You are weary. Rest a while, and take food, and be ready when I return." "I will, lord," said Faramir, "for who would lie idle when the king has returned?" "Farewell then for a while," said Aragorn. "I must go to others who need me." And he left the chamber with Gandalf and Imrahil, but Bergond and his son remained behind, unable to contain their joy. As he followed Gandalf and shut the door, Pippin heard Irwerth exclaim, "King, did you hear that? What did I say? The hands of a healer, I said." And soon the word had gone from the house that the king was indeed come among them. And after war, he brought healing. And the news ran through the city.
Nice.
Nice. Thanks. Yeah. All right. So yeah, I did not remember this part being as cool as it was like on previous rereads and stuff. So anyways, this was sweet. Clearly now it's basically explicitly stated. We're getting into not just Return of the King, Return of Christ, the King kind of territory, right?
Kind of miracle of healing.
Right. Right. So first thoughts though, ever and anon he called the name of Faramir, but each time more faintly to their hearing, as if Aragorn himself was removed from them and walked afar in some dark vale. What do we think of that?
It's like if Faramir is lost in some like shadow spirit world, Aragorn is like going in there himself to fetch Faramir, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it reminded me, since we're in Christ the King territory, it reminded me like the... You know, what shepherd doesn't leave the 99 sheep to seek the lost one, you know, which like that's the famous parable, even though that's not true. No shepherd abandons 99 sheep to go find one. Like that was radical. Like Jesus knew it was radical when he said that. But yeah, so but anyways, that's what I thought, like because it almost did seem out of place. But then I don't know. Maybe that starts to make sense of it. Like. Oh yeah, Jesus, like he'll go to the deepest depths to rescue us, you know, just like what Aragorn's kind of doing here, right? So yeah, so we're in Jesus territory where he's constantly like healing people throughout the Gospels, you know. I mean, it's like if you read this Gospels cover to cover, it's just left and right, you know, like it's almost like filler transition stuff that he's like healing people. And it's usually just by touch, breath. There's like one instance where he kind of rubs spit mixed with mud and just, you know, to make some sort of like healing clay like once. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's usually kind of pretty simple stuff. So that's kind of what Aragorn's doing here, except he needs, supposedly he needs this Ethelas stuff. So that's what we could talk about here. What, unless you got something else.
No, sure.
Yeah, so do you think he actually needs this material plant to help him? Another thought is, too, does he need the elf stone, the green stone, to help him, too? Because that might have healing powers from Galadriel.
It definitely seems like he's bringing his life force into this in some way. And he is, like, the one doing the healing in a way that no one else can do. And that's kind of the prophecy tale that, you know, the hands of a king or the hands of a healer that we heard. He's fulfilling that now. So it seems like it's mostly him. But on the other hand, the herb is something crucial because he's unable to heal Faramir until the herb shows up, right?
Yeah. All right. So this is like a really, really nuanced thing. I think I wrote it down right, but I should be able to reason it out if I didn't write this down right. But every time these characters, we've seen it with Gandalf, like how he resurrects from the dead and stuff. It's like, all right, we're not supposed to see him as Christ, just a Christ-like figure.
Okay.
Like super nuanced. But so anyways, Joseph Pierce starts us off here. He says, we need to remind ourselves that kingship itself is only legitimate insofar as it holds its authority from God. All true kings are only true insofar as they reflect the true kingship of Christ. All lesser images, such as Aragorn's connection to Arthur or the Jacobite kings in exile that we've talked about before, fall into the shadow in the presence of Christ's kingship, which Aragorn's kingship reflects. Okay? So then Fleming Rutledge, she continues it too. She says, yet again, we must insist that we are not comparing Aragorn or anyone else in the story to Christ in any direct way, and we are not suggesting that Tolkien means to do so. This is one of the great many instances in the saga where, however the characters exhibit qualities derived from Christ, gifts of the Holy Spirit, as the apostles did, as they performed the healings recorded in the Acts of the Apostles. Paul wrote, the Christian disciples are confirmed to Christ, that we have in the mind of Christ, that Christ is formed in us. Does any of that make sense?
The first part more so. You lost me a little bit with the last sentence or two.
Aragorn's not actually kind of doing this himself. He's being like given or permitted to have this power, right?
Okay.
So, again, that's like the nuance of this thing. So it's like he's acting like Christ, kind of just like how
he's channeling Christ. He is not Christ,
right? And like just like how the disciples in Acts of the Apostles, because that's what happens. Like all, you know, like St. Peter and St. John and everybody, and St. Paul especially, they're all in Acts of the Apostles. And like, what do they do after Jesus? It's like Peter's healing people, like in the name of Jesus Christ. And you see that, like, you know, like if any little. The actual thing or like the spoofs, like you see like of the Exorcist movies, they say, you know, in the name of Jesus Christ, right? You know, like they're using that to heal people. So it's like it's not actually them. It's, yeah, like you're saying, they're kind of channeling it, or it's being channeled in them. Like passive voice is pretty important here, you know?
Okay, interesting.
So the Ethelas, the king's foil, you know, it's something that kind of like the Dunedain or Elrond, you know, because they're kind of distant ancestors and stuff, are being allowed to use, you know, like, does that make sense? Like,
okay,
through this instrument, they're being allowed to use this power.
But you're saying it's kind of like the conduit, right? Or the spark for the conduit, maybe?
Yeah, and it's almost not even actually super necessary, besides that it was prophesied that this would be the kingship. So it's like, yeah, this is what we're going to use as the conduit because it was prophesied, and this will show everybody, like, it's living up to the prophecy.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah.
So that was the one thing. And this is, here's another personal thought. The Ethelas, it has this sweet smelling air about it. So that reminded me of, so supposedly there's all sorts of reports, and they come out every so often, every few years, about the Holy Sepulchre Church. So that's the one that's in Jerusalem, and it's supposedly on the site of Jesus' tomb and where he was crucified, because I guess they're close together, and the church is really big, and it can encompass both of them, I guess. All right, that part confused me because I haven't seen it myself. But supposedly, Well, not supposedly. They have opened up that tomb, like the slab of rock that like Jesus was laying on and everything. They've opened that multiple times before and like very far apart. And every time they open it, everybody notes that there's this really sweet fragrance. Like it's just always, it always smells like that. And then they've said the same thing about apparitions of like Mary or the saints appearing to people. Like there's the same sweet fragrance in the air all the time. And it's like, I don't know. I saw a connection to the Athelas stuff here, but
interesting. Okay. Yeah. I've never heard that before, but
it's very, yeah. And it's like, how do, I don't know. How do you explain that? You know?
Right,
but,
right.
But it always comes up and these are like the scientists that are, you know, doing this and like, yeah, they always comment on it, but I don't know. Kind of funny. Let's see. This Irareth lady too, somebody pointed out, maybe she's like, she's kind of like the biblical figure Anna, who's at the presentation of the temple. If you know what that is, that's fine. But other people, we can just move on. You know, if people know what that is, that's there's a resemblance there. But she was like waiting for the birth of Christ, and then she got to see it in the temple when Jesus was a baby. So it's kind of like this, because like this Irareth lady was waiting too. Oh, and then, yeah, one last thing. Apparently, this is, like, a last Macbeth reference, too. Possibly. Like, it's the more important thing is the Christ thing, but there's a Macbeth reference in here, and it's
the really hands piling of the, them on.
I know, right? And in this one, I'm like, well, I'm not going to say I'm skeptical about it, but I'm just going to read it here. It's so the hands of a healer. Apart from the obvious references to the healing powers of Christ in the gospel, Tolkien's love for Anglo-Saxon England would have made him well aware of the Anglo-Saxon king, St. Edward the Confessor, who was known to have such miraculous powers of healing. A fact Shakespeare alludes to in Macbeth, in which the true kingship of Edward the Confessor is contrasted with the murderous Machiavellianism of Macbeth. So I said I was like slightly skeptical to bring this up because I don't remember where that guy was in the book. Edward the Confessor, I don't remember him at all. So, I don't know if they just referenced him in that or something, but yeah, I don't know. Anyways, it's there. Felt like we should mention it since because of that, but I don't know. Do you, what else do you think of this healing stuff of Aragorn?
From, well, we got it right at the very end of the passage. Aside from like the symbolism and everything and the significance, it's definitely... I think a political dimension too, kind of what I was saying earlier. Like the rumors spread, we get the impression that Irareth immediately goes spreading rumors, and even if it's not her specifically, word that he has brought Faramir back from the dead spreads, and so the message, the exact wording, word had gone out that the king was indeed among them. So people are like, okay, he fulfilled the prophecy. So that's always a good sign, fulfilling prophecies. And then after war, he brought healing. So it's suddenly like Aragorn himself is being tied to victory in battle and saving all these people who almost died in battle. So that's like a huge plus for him from the perspective of the people. It's like, this isn't some imposter showing up.
Right.
Not only is he fulfilling a prophecy, but he's also delivering clear results, and it's not all destruction. So he's like it's not, I'm not saying like he's being political, but from the politics of ascending to the throne, this positions him very well.
And I thought that was more just like Christ references again, because it's like when you read the gospels, it's like, oh, he heals some people in the town, and then news of it spreads like wildfire that there's this guy performing all these miracles just as it was kind of prophesied and stuff. And it's like, oh, I don't know. I think this fits up more like just with that, especially since Jesus, like, I think we tried to talk about this, like this, the spiritual warfare dimension to it. It's like, you know, what Jesus is doing at the crucifixion and the resurrection. It's like, yeah, this is winning a higher dimension war kind of against evil, like, you know, like once and for all and stuff. But then it's also like, yeah, but you know, a good king isn't just a war leader. You know, there's the whole almost opposite end of the spectrum. Like he's really good as like the healer too. And so it's like very cool touch by Tolkien, like I said at the beginning, to include a whole chapter. Like the king's not just about bringing war. The king's about bringing peace, bringing healing, you know, like real healing here, you know? So I think it's pretty sweet. Pretty awesome. Okay, so that brings us to Eowyn. So where did we leave off with Eowyn's story before she became Durnhelm and Dunharrow.
Before she became Durnhelm.
Yeah, I know. It's really far back. I can barely
remember. We heard... it was when Aragorn was passing through, right? On his way to the Paths of the Dead. And Eowyn was totally distraught. Why are you doing that? And I don't think it was ever really said outright, but we get the impression that she has eyes for Aragorn, wants him to stay, and is totally defeated that he's leaving.
Yep. And then the next chapter two... Well, she had begged to go with Aragorn as well. That's very mm-hmm. noteworthy. And we had also said in that second chapter when she was meeting with Aragorn, like, we were trying to highlight how Aragorn's pretty admirably being the self-sacrificing, like, just servant. Because it's like, I see all these prophecies. I'm pretty sure they're about me. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they are, because it's the only way that we're going to win this battle. I got to take the paths of the dead, even though nobody's ever passed before. And I'm just going to follow. I'm going to, like, be the servant of, like, you know, this hopeful providence to get me through, right? Mm-hmm. And Eowyn kind of wanted to even just be Aragorn's servant, go with him and stuff, you know, like beg to go. And he said, no, you got to do your duty, which is not following me, right? And he felt bad about doing it too. And Eowyn, you know, she kind of wanted to go with him out of seemingly kind of loving him, but then definitely because this is her final chance to do something heroic and not be cooped up for once, right, on the mm-hmm. sidelines. But then we also did see her at the beginning of the third chapter when Théoden and Éomer showed up, because obviously they greeted her. Mm-hmm. And then basically that's ended with her Théoden saying, well, you know, you're going to do your duty and like watch the people while I'm gone again. You know, you are mm-hmm. going to sit on the sidelines, right? Mm-hmm. And then she becomes Durnhelm and takes Merry and they go and kill the Witch King. We know all that. Mm-hmm. But the question is, did she do it like kind of her way? My way, as Frank Sinatra would say, you know, did she break her servant duty to kind of Théoden, who, because she was supposed to watch all the people, and I mean, she didn't do that. Mm-hmm. But then it also seems like she got rewarded because she gets to kill the Witch King, you know, the Lord of the Nazgul, right?
Right.
Or did it somewhere become kind of clear that her servant duty had kind of changed? Like maybe she was supposed to go to this battle, mm-hmm. especially since it kind of seems like it's not kind of was her destiny to be the killer of the Nazgul. Cause it's like, you know, it was prophesied only a woman or not a man could do this, you know? Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think that she broke the oath with Théoden. I think that I don't know that it was so explicit about what she had kind of signed up to do or promised. I think Théoden was making sure that his people were safe. And he also had an idea. He wanted her to be safe, ultimately didn't want her to go to battle. And I got the impression he sort of created the role of her being in charge of staying home as a way of protecting her, not because it had to be exactly her to be the one defending them. And so yeah. I think she walked back on what she was supposed to be doing on that front, but for the better, and had justification for doing it. Well, he's also like, we talked a bit, I don't remember exactly what we were saying when she attacked the Nazgul, but the whole, like, she's totally, both in the time when Tolkien was writing this and also in the setting of the book, she's totally breaking with her gender norms.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's a pretty radical woman. And I think it would be, it's like almost expected that every man around her, like Théoden or Éomer, would, even if they know she's capable of more, would still expect her to take the backseat role, you know? So it's like almost on her in a way to go beyond that anyway, to like push her own.
Or maybe it's on Théoden and Éomer not realizing her role, you know? Like,
yeah,
maybe
exactly.
Them for just, you know, assuming.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like love her, they respect her, they know she's strong. But they're kind of like, it's not even crossing their mind that she could be useful mm-hmm. in the battle, right? So yeah. I think it's fair from her standpoint, because I think she kind of knows what she's capable of, and therefore is, I don't know what the best way to put it is like almost better informed about what her role can be than Théoden is.
Yeah, well, and then this scene that we're about to read also okay. helps forward that a bit. So let's jump in. So Aragorn moves straight on to it, says Eowyn, the shield arm is the one that's broken, but again, it's the sword arm that stabbed the Nazgul, and that's the real problem, just like it was for Merry at the beginning of the chapter. So what does Aragorn say here? He says, alas, for she was pitted against a foe beyond the strength of her mind or body, and for those who will take a weapon to such an enemy must be sterner than steel, if the very shock shall not destroy them. It was an evil doom that set her in his path, for she is a fair maiden, fairest lady of a house of queens, and yet I know not how I should speak of her. When I first looked on her and perceived her unhappiness, it seemed to me that I saw a white flower standing straight and proud, shapely as a lily, and yet knew that it was hard, as if wrought by elf rites out of steel. Or was it maybe a frost that had turned its sap to ice? And so it stood, bittersweet, still fair to see, but stricken, soon to fall or die. Her malady begins far back, before this day, does it not, Éomer?
I marvel that you should ask me, Lord, he answered, for I hold you blameless in this matter, as in all else. Yet I knew not that Éowyn, my sister, was touched by any frost, until she first looked on you. Care and dread she had, and shared with me, in the days of Wormtongue and the king's bewitchment, and she tended the king in growing fear. But that did not bring her to this pass.
My friend, said Gandalf, you had horses and deeds of arms and free fields, but she, born in the body of a maid, had a spirit and courage at least the match of yours. Yet she was doomed to wait upon an old man whom she loved as a father and watch him falling into a mean, dishonored dotage. And her part seemed to her more ignoble than that of the staff he leaned on. And he goes on, Gandalf goes on to add that, you know, Wormtongue's poison probably didn't only poison just Théoden's ears. You know, like, Éowyn was there the whole time. She probably had to sit through this crap, too. You know, and it started to affect her, too. You know?
Yeah, I read that specific, like what with the Wormtongue thing. At first, I was like, what was it implying that she was, like, corrupted by him or something? And it seems maybe more like Gandalf is suggesting that Wormtongue was constantly, like, oh, all these Rohan people, they're so lowly, they're just scum, they're just like
barn but he people. Was doing that in a very subtle way, not openly.
Right. But like kind of demeaning them and like undermining their power and stature all the time. And that was what she was absorbing, was like this like baseness combined with her own sense of powerlessness because of her position in the whole thing. So it seems like this was like a chronic, she's got all this passion, but feels completely helpless.
Yeah.
You know, it feels pretty trapped.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, because I don't remember where the scene is in the book. I remember where it is in the movie, but she always talked about, like, you know, she feared, like, the cage, you know, and stuff. And it's like, well, she's kind of living it with Wormtongue. You know? It's like, she's stuck with Wormtongue and an old man, you know, like, senile old man who is falling for all the evil stuff around him, right,
and it sounds like there is, like, not only does she feel trapped, but she's like she feels complicit in Théoden's own, like, you know, destruction, shriveling, whatever.
Yeah, so now, even though it's against gender norms, you know, maybe Théoden and Éomer, they miscalculated not letting her go to battle, because Gandalf's almost suggesting, like, if she had followed her duty. You know, because her duty, though, had been poisoned by Wormtongue because she was living with them this whole time, you know? That would have been, like, a dark end for her, you know, if she had just kept that current course of, like, just sitting out on the sidelines, right?
Yeah.
So maybe her riding to war with Merry was, like, as liberating a thing as, like, Théoden riding out to war after Gandalf had freed him from Wormtongue's kind of poison.
Yeah. Another thought with, like, the whole oath thing is, like, she kind of was, like, sworn to defend and help Théoden all along. And so she felt like totally wronged as she was helping him become this sickly old man by Wormtongue's side. So it was like fulfilling her own oath to Théoden to go help him at the very end of things, you know?
Right.
So anyways.
Yeah. All right. So let's see. Let's keep going here. Then Éomer was silent and looked on his sister, as if pondering anew all the days of their past life together. But Aragorn said, I also saw what you saw, Éomer. Few other griefs amid the ill chances of this world have more bitterness and shame for a man's heart than to behold the love of a lady so fair and brave that cannot be returned. Sorrow and pity have followed me ever since I left her desperate in Dunharrow and rode to the paths of the dead. And no fear upon that way was so present as the fear of for what might befall her. And yet, Éomer, I say to you that she loves you more truly than me. For you she loves and knows, but in me she loves only a shadow and a thought, a hope of glory and great deeds, and lands far away from the fields of Rohan. I have, maybe, the power to heal her body and to recall her from the dark valley, but to what she will awake, hope or forgetfulness or despair, I do not know. And if to despair, then she will die, unless other healings come which I cannot bring. Alas, for her deeds have set her among the queens of great renown. All right, do you want to translate what Aragorn said?
Okay, I think he's basically saying, like, I know, I recognize that she loved me, even the short time that I passed through the land, but I don't think she really loved me. I think she just loved, I was in the right place at the right time, you know?
I read it like she loved what he represented.
Okay, yeah, I guess, yeah.
Like a noble warrior, you know?
Noble warrior, and then also a chance to escape this like totally screwed up situation she's stuck in. And so, and she recognized his nobility and his honor and whatever. So he's kind of saying like, nothing, it's not specific to me. It was just like, it happened to be me at that moment.
Yeah.
Which is also, it's a convenient play for Aragorn to like not get too involved, you know, because he's committed elsewhere.
Right. And where else is he committed, Clifford?
To Arwen, right?
Right. We're due to talk about her because she's like we won't. She was in Rivendell, and that's been about it. So we're due to do the Aragorn and Arwen history, which shouldn't be too much. So I don't know. Right. Look for that in a coming chapter soon, or mini special or something. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. But then critically, Aragorn is saying to Éomer, like, for when she wakes up. She needs something to live for. She needs she needs a motivation in life, which could come in the form of love, but it can't be to me because I'm not going to be here. So if she loves me, and she's just going to be disappointed. She's going to die.
Yeah.
So she has to love somebody as a motivation for life. And so I think Aragorn's kind of saying like the brotherly love she has for you, Éomer, might be that thing to keep her alive.
Yeah.
So. You should be standing here when she wakes up, basically.
Well, so that's what happens is Aragorn, he does this similar healing process with Faramir, except this time I think he kisses her at some point. So it's like, obviously that's an added thing. Kissed her brow. Yeah. But then, so it's a similar thing. It's a cool description, but we're already now running long, so let's not read it. And Éowyn wakes up, but as soon as she like begins to stir, Aragorn immediately leaves the room so that when she opens her eyes, Éomer is the first person she sees. Mm-hmm. And then Éomer and Gandalf greet her. Gandalf, you know, he's like pretty happy about it, but a couple lines of dialogue, and Éowyn herself is already saying like, it's an open question whether health and hope can ever be fully restored to her, which kind of just confirms what Aragorn said. Like, she's going to need some other sort of healing that I can't give her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then we get to the third massive healing of this chapter, but Tolkien really streamlines this Merry one, because it's basically the same thing as the other ones.
Yeah, we know the role. There's Aragorn touches them, he's got the two leaves in the water.
Yeah. Calls him by name, right? Fresh scent, yes, okay. Mm-hmm. And then Merry wakes up immediately, and he says he's hungry. Okay, so that's like... universal sign that a hobbit's probably okay. Right? But this is also actually a reference to the Gospels again. And this isn't just hobbits, because like when Faramir woke up, Aragorn told him to eat something. So like when Jesus heals people, if it's like a really specific one especially, they'll probably have a reference like, oh, they ate food. And so when they eat food, that... yes, it proves they're kind of back to normal, like what we just said with hobbits, but also proves that you're fully alive again, because some of these people that he's healing were dead. And so it's like, you know, that was proof for ancient people. It's like, well, dead people can't eat anything. Like, it doesn't, you know, it just, if they're ghosts, it would just go through them or something. But it's like, if you can eat something, then, yeah, you actually are alive again. And that's like why when Jesus resurrects himself, he immediately, like, there's lines that he has fish. Like, he's like, hey, you guys got any fish? You know, give me some of that. And, like, that's to prove that he's, like, actually alive. But anyways, yeah, so Tolkien, he's totally working sin, but he's also having fun hobbit banter. And then Mary says, I want to smoke too, you know, like not just eat, I want to smoke and like have a nice night, right? But then he says, oh, wait, no. Smoking reminds me of Théoden, and that makes me sad because we didn't actually get to talk about the Herb Lord that I really wanted to talk about him with him, you know. And Aragorn butts in, and what does he say?
Smoke then and think of him, said Aragorn, for he was a gentle heart and a great king and kept his oaths, and he rose out of the shadows to a last fair morning. Though your service to him is brief, it should be a memory glad and honorable to the end of your days.
Merry smiled. Well then, he said, if Strider will provide what is needed, I will smoke and think. I had some of Saruman's best in my pack, but what became of it in battle, I am sure I don't know.
Master Meriadoc, said Aragorn, if you think that I have passed through the mountains and the realm of Gondor with fire and sword to bring herbs to a careless soldier who throws away his gear, you are mistaken. If your pack has not been found, then you must send for the herb master of this house. And he will tell you that he did not know that the herb you desire had any virtues, but that it is called Westman's Weed by the vulgar, and Galenus by the noble, and other names, and other tongues more learned. And after adding a few half-forgotten rhymes that he does not understand, he will regretfully inform you that there is none in the house, and he will leave you to reflect on the history of tongues. And so now must I, for I have not slept in such a bed as this since I rode from Dunhower, nor eaten since the dark before the dawn.
Merry seized his hand and kissed it. I am frightfully sorry, he said. Go at once. Ever since that night at Bree, we have been a nuisance to you. But it is the way of my people to use light words at such times and say less than they mean. We fear to say too much. It robs us of the right words when a jest is out of place.
I know that well, or I would not deal with you in the same way, said Aragorn. May the Shire live forever unwithered. And in kissing Mary, he went out, and Gandalf went with him.
All right, so that's pretty good. Yeah. Satisfying banter. Because it's like now everybody's healed, so it's like if we want to do like, you know, bumbling lines from these herb masters, this is fine. Because now everybody's like healed up, right? Aragorn hasn't properly slept since Dunhower. Harrow? It was 10 days ago. That's like maybe we've talked about it before and we're not going to do anything big now. But it's like, you know, that is a lowest key, one of the fun things to keep track of in Lord of the Rings is how sleep deprived all these people are. And I gotta say, of all the characters in Lord of the Rings, I think Aragorn takes it for most sleep deprived and lightest sleeper of all time. So, I mean, it's nuts to think what they do. Frodo and Sam are a close second and third for when they in book four, and then maybe what happens next, we'll see, but maybe they're already dead.
It's basically impossible to find Aragorn sleeping.
Right.
If you really found him, he's awake. So yeah, the only times he's sleeping is possibly when everyone else is asleep.
Yeah, yeah. All right, but then here we get the end of the joke. Pippin remained behind. Was there ever anyone like him, he said, except Gandalf, of course. I think they must be related. My dear ass, your pack is lying by your bed, and you had it on your back when I met you. He saw this all of the time, of course. You know, so it's like, so Aragorn did that whole rip into Merry, but it's right, it was, like, that was a joke too.
You think I'm serving a soldier who forgets his gear.
Yeah, like. Yeah. And it's like Aragorn knew the gear was on the side of the wall. So that's pretty funny. So then after that, they break out the stuff to start smoking and just enjoy. I guess it's evening, though. It's pretty late in the night, so I don't know. I would just go back to sleep, but whatever. We talked about it, too, like the contrasting styles in Lord of the Rings, you know, like hierarchy of styles, like sometimes a super high epic language, then it's like low language like this. This is another good chapter that kind of just highlighted that whole thing, I would say. We don't have to talk about that again, though. So the chapter ends, though, with Aragorn leaving the House of the Healing. And why don't you just take that first paragraph and I'll do that last shorter paragraph.
At the doors of the houses, many were already gathered to see Aragorn, and they followed after him. And when at last he had supped, men came and prayed that he would heal their kinsmen or their friends whose lives were in peril through hurt or wound, or who lay under the black shadow. And Aragorn arose and went out, and he sent for the sons of Elrond. And together they labored far into the night. And word went through the city, the king is come again indeed. And they named him Elfstone, because of the green stone that he wore. And so the name which it was foretold at his birth that he should bear was chosen for him by his own people.
And when he could labor no more, he cast his cloak about him and slipped out of the city, and went to his tent just ere dawn and slept for a little. And in the morning, the banner of Dol Amroth A white ship, like a swan upon blue water, floated from the tower, and men looked up and wondered if the coming of the king had been but a dream. I think it's super cool chapter ending. Definitely. But yeah, it beats you over the head, though. Like, this is, I mean, you know, coming and healing everybody in the town, everybody bringing their sick to heal him is like, dude, this is spitting gospels. Jesus, like, these are, like, literally the transitions every town Jesus goes to. It's like, he healed all the people, and then he moved on to the next town. You know, like, that's mm-hmm. how you could just transition from story to story. Mm-hmm. What do we think of the addition of the Sons of Elrond in it, though?
It was, it's kind of practical, right? It's yep. like Aragorn is, if the setup is he's healed a few of the important people, and then everyone else is like, oh, help me too. In other contexts, this would is like the time where you see lines like, oh, you know, we're on to other important things or whatever.
Yeah.
But the fact that Aragorn not only is like, okay, I will do everything I can, yep. and gets the Sons of Elrond who have the same abilities, we understand. That's like they're in a pragmatic fashion giving it their all.
Yeah. And the Sons of Elrond being able to do this too, it kind of reinforces that derivative power. Like, it's not Aragorn's own. Like, this has been entrusted to Elrond and his sons. And, you know, like, if you go all the way back, like, they're all descendants of Arendil, actually. You know, so like, maybe this was conferred on, like, you know, bloodlines or something too. So, yeah. The people name him Elfstone. I thought this one was like a little bit of a push, like self-fulfilling, because it's like Aragorn was put on the stone himself, you know?
Right.
But it's like, I don't know, sometimes that's the way prophecies go, and I'm actually kind of fine with that. But, you know, it's like, oh, the people chose the name themselves. Like, all right, I guess. But, you know, if I wrote Patrick across my chest, people would start calling me Patrick. I don't know what to say. And then I would say I do love the ending of this chapter, because there's better ones in Rohan, but I think this was the ultimate fairy tale come to life in Minas Tirith, you know, because it's like they woke up, like they had this awesome night, you know, they were, all these rumors were spreading, but then was it all a dream? I mean, because it's just the Dol Amroth guy that's in charge up there. I don't know, maybe I was dreaming it, you know.
It also feels like more, it could be more like kind of religious biblical reference, like if you're not sure about something, like, do you actually believe in it, or are you, you know, is it when you, if you no longer have like tangible presence or something,
yeah,
you have belief, or you can like doubt your memory and be like, maybe it was just a dream and these people got better on their own.
Yeah. Right?
And then it's kind of like up in the air, and it,
right.
I feel like that shows up in the Bible, is like the kind of people have to like choose to believe in a way in some of those settings.
Yeah. All right, last thing to talk about, really quick. Let's just put a spoiler on just in case. All right, so you know about, like, the rest of the book and everything. Do you think with this chapter, because the movie only makes it an extended scene, and it's really, really quick, do we think with this chapter there's enough sufficient Return of the King time in Return of the King? I don't know, what do you think? Like, does Aragorn get, like, enough time in the book? Or should like, because sometimes
enough
I have
time
thought,
in the movie.
Movie and book, either one.
Okay.
Like, I mean, you could discuss both, but because like what I would kind of say is, Lord of the Rings maybe could do with one less chapter from book one, and then one more chapter specifically about Aragorn doing something in Return of the King. I've thought that before. I have my take, my new take now. But what do you think first?
I think I agree with that. I don't know if I would take it out of chapter one necessarily.
No, out of book one. Like you know,
or
like
book one.
Trim one of the Bombadil chapters down.
Or sorry, that's what I mean.
You know? that's what I would say.
Other than maintaining symmetry, I personally would maybe take it out of Frodo and Sam venturing through before they get to Mordor.
Okay.
But I know there's a reason that drags on. Like, it's supposed to. You're supposed to feel it. But anyways, yeah. I do agree. I think there's so many things going on plot-wise at this moment, and it's more spread out in the book, so it's easier to follow. But in the movie, it's like, this is why there's seven endings, right? And so there's like not enough setup to totally understand the significance of Aragorn by himself.
Yeah,
it's just broke. It's woven in with all these other things. So I think definitely the movie could have given more more playtime to this, what we just talked through, and then the book could also have given even more build up for Aragorn's character.
Yeah. So what I would say, the movie definitely needed more time. This, I think, is actually sufficient, but in my personal taste, so this is the nuanced part of it, I would say that Aragorn, he gets enough time in the spotlight, but he doesn't get enough personal time in the spotlight. Because like I said at the beginning, I think it's like that epic narrator that's taking over, and he's much less personal. And so it's like, so Aragorn, he's got all these cool epic scenes and stuff, but he doesn't have enough of the personal scenes, like definitely like what the hobbits have, you know?
Right.
And so
right.
It's like, just maybe missing just a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I think like, yeah, enough time here, but that's, it feels a little bit more aloof, even though he's being really cool throughout it and upstanding, yeah. You know?
Like these few moments where he's like talking about his name Strider or joking around with Mary, right. Or like those are his unique moments. Yeah. And there's only like a couple conversations, it feels like, in the whole story where he reveals like his true personality. He's not just like the stern guy calling the shots or leading a charge or doing something noble.
And thinking of this like a historical text written 200 years later, it's like I said, that idea, he's smushing two narratives together or two accounts together, but it's like he probably only left like the Strider part in there, you know, like talking about his name, because it's like, oh, where does the name Tel Kantar come from, you know, for the royal house? And it's like, oh, here's the origins of that. He just liked the name Strider and he kept it, you know, as like a little personal tribute to his northern life, early northern life, you know. I don't know. That's what I'm just kind of thinking, but
yeah.
Oh, that's all I got for tonight.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, I think this is good.
I think we motored through that.
Yeah, it wasn't short, but yeah, it wasn't as bad as it could have been, but yeah. Last chapter was a feat to stretch 8 pages into like 90 minutes. hopefully this was the big one, and these obnoxiously long episodes are kind of done now, but we'll see. I'm sure they're not, so but this is good. All right, cool.
Thanks, y'all.